To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sbrav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station the next hour for more information, 430-9722. Next, we have member of the British Parliament, George Galloway, speaking recently in Seattle.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, for that. There was somebody following me around in Wisconsin the other night with a T-shirt saying, "We love the troops." Well, we love the troops too. That's why we want to bring them home before any more of them get killed. Eight more in the last 24 hours. Eight more Americans. I don't know, because I'm away from the news, whether there's any increase in the British death toll as a result of the extraordinary incidents in Basra. I don't know if that's being covered in the American media, where two British soldiers dressed as Arabs, who may have been carrying explosives, which opens up a very interesting potential can of worms. If true, what were they doing with explosives, and where were they going with the explosives? And how many other explosions have been not necessarily carried out by the people we were told they were carried out by? You think I'm being paranoid, you haven't read Graham Greene's The Quiet American or seen the movie or know anything about the history of colonialism and provocations and so on. But I don't know if the British death toll has increased, but I do know that nearly 2,000 young American men now lie in the ground as a result of this grotesque blunder, this terrible crime that was committed in Iraq. And I do know, at least I believe, that well over 100,000 Iraqis also lie in the ground. Though when I said that the other day in the debate with Christopher Hitchens, I quoted the Johns Hopkins University and the Lancet, the Journal of the British Medical Association, in their study which showed over 100,000 civilian deaths in Iraq since the invasion, not counting the deaths in Fallujah, which would have skewed their survey, so great was the death toll there. When I said that, Mr. Hitchens said they were crazed fabricators. I was so shocked at that, I asked him to repeat it, and he repeated it. And I was so shocked, I asked if there was really anyone in this audience who believed one of the world's great universities, Johns Hopkins Universities, and one of the most prestigious and respectable medical journals in the world, The Lancet, really were crazed fabricators. And a section of the hall shouted, "Yes, yes, they are crazed fabricators." Well, I tell you this, if I have to choose who to believe, between Johns Hopkins University and The Lancet, or Christopher Hitchens and George W. Bush, I know who I'm believing. I know who I'm believing. So, it's definitely not because we hate the troops. It's the opposite of hating the troops to say they should not be sent to kill or be killed anymore for this terrible crime and this pack of lies that I talk about. After all, how could we hate the troops? Who are the troops? The troops are conscripted by high unemployment, by low wages, by poverty, by racism, by poor prospects, by a sense of despair of making any kind of life for themselves in the civilian society. Recruited in high schools, in your country at least, recruited in universities in both of our countries, recruited in parking lots, recruited down on the mean streets of industrial and post-industrial Britain and the United States, and sent as workers with a gun to kill other workers. These are the troops. And it's because we don't hate the troops that we demand their withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else that George Bush and Tony Blair have sent them. And the last thing I'm not here to do is to speak for Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. This lunatic today, Medved, he seemed actually surprised to learn that I hadn't come directly from the Tora Bora with the latest instructions from the Emir. Let's be clear about something. Osama bin Laden has nothing to do with us. Osama bin Laden was invented, armed, financed, and sent to Afghanistan by the United States of America and Great Britain and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Turkey. We won't allow any rewriting of history about this. If you'll permit me to quote myself, on the night before the fall of Kabul, to bin Laden and the Mujahideen, so-called, the fathers of the Taliban, I said to Mrs. Thatcher, though I was the last man standing in the British Parliament saying this, that wasn't the last time that was to happen. I said to Mrs. Thatcher, in the British Parliament, you have opened the gates for the barbarians, and a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan. And I never said a truer word. We have to tell the Medveds of the world, whether they want to hear it or not, over and over again, don't try and hang Osama bin Laden round our neck. He was your man, and he went to Afghanistan to do your dirty work, which is one of the many reasons why we say that the attack on Afghanistan after 9/11 was doubly unjust. There were no Afghans on those airplanes that struck the United States. No Afghan ever hurt any American. Most of the Afghans who have been slaughtered since 9/11 don't even know where the United States is. Never heard of Seattle, Washington. Don't know about Boeing and its plant and its anti-union practices. The poorest, most ragged people on the earth were bombarded by the most powerful and richest people on earth. And they did nothing wrong to the United States. Sure, the Taliban and bin Laden were living on their territory because we sent them there and helped them win the war that put them in power. And so, having inflicted these people on the Afghans, we then punished the Afghans for the fact that these people were in charge of them. Now, we are very clear about this. The act of mass murder that took place on 9/11 in New York, took place on 7/7 in London, took place earlier in the railway carriages in Madrid, were criminal acts of mass murder. It is a crime, it is a sin in any language, in any religion, to punish innocent people for the crimes of guilty people. It's a crime. It's a big crime. The difference between us and Bush is, we say it's a crime to kill innocent people for the crimes of guilty people, whether it's happening in Kabul or Baghdad or Fallujah or London or New York or Madrid or anywhere else in the world. That's the big difference between him and us. You see, when the wives of our President and Prime Minister, on the anniversary of 9/11, I'm going to come back to Mrs. Bush Senior later on, and Mrs. Blair, they gave a A radio broadcast synchronized swimming in the grief of the anniversary of 9/11. They invited us in their joint broadcast never to forget those heartbreaking messages of love and farewell left by those poor American women on those airplanes on 9/11 from their mobile telephones, messages left on the answering machines of their loved ones. They asked us never to forget those messages, as if we could. But as I said at the time, just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and their loved ones don't have answering machines, it doesn't make their deaths delivered from the sky any less obscene than the deaths of those women on those aircraft in the United States on 9/11. But you know, that may be a truth self-evident to you and me, but as I looked around the British Parliament whom I was addressing with those words, I could see on the faces of those powerful men, mainly men, in the British Parliament, that that wasn't a self-evident truth at all. We have to face this fact. In the world we have today, run by the people who run it today, the blood of some people is more valuable than the blood of others. Nobody can deny that. There are no minute silences for the dead women in Afghanistan. There are no fundraising concerts to look after the families of those whose breadwinners were killed in the bombardment of Afghanistan. They don't even know how many died in Afghanistan, let alone what their names were. There are no plaques with all their names on it to commemorate them. Very few people even gave them a second thought. They were just collateral damage in the bombardment by the richest, most powerful, upon the poorest and most ragged. Now, most people in the West are oblivious to the fact that this double standard about the value of different people's blood exists. But let me tell you, there are no Muslims in the world who are oblivious to it. Every Muslim in the world knows that an American life is worth more than an Afghan life. A British life is worth more than an Iraqi life. An Israeli life is worth more than a Palestinian life. They all know that. And it's because they know that that so many of them are boiling with rage, a subject to which I shall return again and again. Now, I got into trouble from some sections of the media in New York. Well, the New York Post, actually. It's not really it's the sort of printed equivalent of Mr. Medved. Mr. Rupert Murdoch owns it. He's what I call a serial patriot. He was a patriotic Australian when he owned all the Australian papers. Then he moved to Britain, he became patriotically British. And now he's running Fox Television and the New York Post and all the rest. He's as patriotic as an American can possibly be. But beware, he's building up a lot of interests in China. So, if needs must, it may have to be a different sort of patriotism. So, I got into trouble in the New York Post for saying this, and I'll quote it directly because it's important to the rest of this story this evening. I said, "You may think that those aeroplanes that struck the Twin Towers on 9/11 came out of a clear blue sky. But I believe they emerged from a swamp of hatred and bitterness and enmity against us that exists out there and especially in the Muslim world. And that swamp is being endlessly refilled and replenished with every new injustice that we visit upon the people of the Muslim world. And for some reason that proved exceptional to the New York Post, who appeared to believe that these planes just really did come out of a clear blue sky, that there was no reason why this occurred. Now, to state that there is a reason why it occurred is not to say it was right. It's not to support something to try and understand how it happened. Indeed, if you don't want it to happen again, you have an absolute duty to try and understand how it happened. But it's remarkable how many people, well, they say that there are none so blind as those who will not see. It's remarkable how many people, especially here in the United States, but also in some circles in Britain, have not yet grasped that dichotomy, which is very important to this story. It's because I don't want to see any more 9/11s. I don't want to see any more 7/7s. That I want to drain that swamp of hatred, of the bitterness, and of the enmity that led to these atrocities. I'm not suggesting we negotiate with Bin Laden. As I said that day when the House of Commons was recalled 4 days after 9/11, I despise Osama Bin Laden. The difference is, I've always despised Osama bin Laden. I despised him when you were giving him guns and money and support and telling him what he should be doing. It's because I want to negotiate not with bin Laden or bin Ladenism. I want to negotiate with those who haven't joined him yet. I want to negotiate with those who might join him tomorrow, if we don't drain that swamp of the grievances which are feeding this phenomenon of Islamist, fundamentalist, obscurantist terror. Now, that's common sense to me. It is not Mr. Medved, not, repeat, not me speaking up for bin Laden or bin Ladenism, quite the opposite, in fact. So they asked me, well, what would you do to drain that swamp? I say, well, there are many things, but there are three main things that we have to do, or would have had to do, if we were not going to follow a course of action which we did, which has created 10,000 new bin Ladens, made even more millions of people hate us even more bitterly than they already did. I said, the first thing we have to do, and this is the most important message I have for the United States of America. If you listen to nothing else I say, listen to this. The first reason, the flaw at the heart of the West's policy towards the East, the policy towards the Muslim world of countries like America and Britain, the flaw at the heart of that policy is the more than 50 years of injustice that has been visited upon the Palestinian people, paid for by American money and made possible by American political support. You know, every bullet in the back of a child in the Gaza Strip was paid for here by the United States taxpayer. Every rocket that's ever fired into a refugee camp is fired from an Apache helicopter given to General Sharon by the government of the United States of America and paid for by you. You may not know that. Maybe your people don't know that. There's not a single Muslim in the world who doesn't know that every crime committed by General Sharon is paid for by the United States of America. And when the Security Council convenes to condemn it, you can be sure it will be vetoed by the United States of America. Your people might not have noticed it. Every Muslim in the world has it engraved on their heart as the most grotesque injustice and unfairness and unbalanced policy anywhere in the world, followed by any government, is the unending, bottomless support your government gives to every crime committed by Sharon's Israel. And if you don't wake up and smell that particular coffee, I tell you, you will never be done with this great crisis that exists between the West and the East, which exists between your country and mine and the Muslim world, 1,500 million strong. Let me run that number past you again. 1,500 million Muslims in the world, of whom hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions hate us bitterly, of whom tens of millions are ready to support those who wish to hurt us in retaliation for our injustice, of whom probably hundreds of thousands are ready actually to hurt us, to trade their lives for many of ours. So, if there's no justice for the Palestinian people, there will be no peace in the Middle East. We must understand that. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. Last week was the 23rd anniversary of the massacre of Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut. I remember them well. I used to live in them. That's not an anniversary that was much observed here in America. Not much observed in Britain. Most people, maybe even some in this hall, don't even know what I'm talking about, Sabra and Shatila massacre. But every Muslim in the world remembers the Sabra and Shatila massacre. Let me tell you, or remind you, what happened there. In 1982, the Palestinian fighters left Beirut on board ships under international guarantee that their families left in the refugee camps would be protected. That international guarantee was signed by the ambassador of the United States of America. And no sooner had the ships sailed out of harbor than these refugees, old men, women and children only, no young men left, were fallen upon like wolves. The Israeli forces and their Lebanese fascist allies poured like wolves into the refugee camps and massacred thousands of Palestinian refugees, defenseless, without arms, without men to protect them. And who was in charge? Who was in charge of that massacre? Who was literally standing at the gate of the camp? I mean literally. He's pictured standing at the gate of the camp while the massacre was going on. You're right. General Ariel Sharon. The same Ariel Sharon that Mr. Bush tells us is a man of peace. I mean, even Sharon doesn't consider himself to be a man of peace. But George Bush thinks he's a man of peace. And when Sharon turned up in New York last week for the UN, we were expected to treat him like a statesman with a red carpet. He wasn't treated like Hugo Chavez with his security men denied visas, coming to a country where the president's friend has just threatened to murder him. No. Sharon was brought here and we were asked to be grateful, grateful that he finally, 40 years late, evacuated a few settlements in a small part of the occupied territories. Even though the settlers who were moved from Gaza, every one of those settlers was given $250,000 compensation for leaving stolen land that they should never have been on. Who paid that money? You did. Your government paid that $250,000 to every one of those settlers who illegally occupied other people's land for nearly 40 years against international law. I spent a lot of years trying to rouse the people of the West about the unbelievable disaster that was unfolding in Iraq, where 1 million Iraqis, most of them children, most of them dead before they ever got to know that they were Iraqis, because they were too young, but who died for no other reason than that they were Iraqis. There were only a few of us. A very fine American called Kathy Kelly, Voices in the Wilderness. I don't know if you know her. A fine American congressman, Democratic Party whip in the Congress, David Bonnier of Michigan, who described the policy of these sanctions as infanticide masquerading as politics. The late Pope John Paul II called it the slaughter of the innocents. For more than a decade, an Iraqi child died every 6 minutes of every day and every night as a result of that embargo. It's the biggest mass grave in Iraq, but it's the one mass grave you can be sure Fox TV will not be filming, will not be at the exhumation of its victims, for its victims were victims of us, men in suits, elegant barbarians, in the offices of the United Nations in New York, making decisions that caused the slaughter of 1 million children. Now again, most people in the West didn't want to know about that. They were only Iraqis, they were only Arabs, they were only Muslims. But no Muslim ever forgot it. And it's another of the major reasons why that swamp got ever deeper, and these monsters germinating within it got ever more dangerous. Now, instead of draining the swamp, everything we've done has been to make it deeper. Instead of stopping the blank check for Ariel Sharon, we kept on writing them. Instead of stopping the propping up of the puppet presidents and the corrupt kings, we kept on doing it. And we compounded the massacre of 1 million Iraqis by sanctions, by the invasion and occupation of Iraq. The Bush administration stands naked in front of the whole world, and it's not a pretty sight. We knew that these people were malevolent, but we didn't know they were also utterly incompetent. And these people who cannot even organize in the richest, most powerful country in the world. Actually, if you heard that radio broadcast today with Medved, the whole trouble started out by him introducing the show thus. Welcome to whatever the name of his station is, broadcasting from the greatest nation on the face of God's green earth. I said to him, isn't that a little vainglorious? who awarded you that title? Did you award it to yourself, in which case, what is it worth? Did God award it? If so, when and where? He couldn't get me. He couldn't understand why that would be offensive to me. I said, well, I think my nation's quite good too, you know. So do the people of Norway, and France, and Germany, and Italy, and Greece, and every nation in the world. None of us except you're greater than us, you know. That statement, analyze it. That statement that this is the greatest nation on the face of God's green earth means that everybody else in every other nation is less than you. And this is the problem, you see. The rest of the world believes that you think that. But I said to him, well, I've been looking at New Orleans. You don't look so great down on the streets of New Orleans. I must tell you that. I must tell you that.
That was George Galloway, a member of the British Parliament, speaking recently in Seattle. We had to cut his talk for space, but an hour-long version of his excellent talk is available on radio4all.net. Next, we have Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hussein Ibish, Executive Director of the Foundation for Arab American Leadership, who discusses the results of Iraq's October 15th constitutional referendum. Constitutional Attorney John Boniface, who examines the investigation into the White House disclosure of a CIA agent's identity and the possible implication of President Bush in more serious crimes related to the Iraq War. And Alex Wilson, executive editor of Environmental Building News, who discusses a plan for rebuilding New Orleans using 21st century environmentally sustainable construction techniques. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Pressure is building to delay Haiti's upcoming election. Voter registration has fallen far short of expectations, and groups like the Catholic Church's Peace and Justice Commission and Grassroots International question the fairness of the process. The U.S.-installed interim government in Haiti has delayed the election twice, and the new date is set for sometime in December. Already, 32 candidates for president have started campaigning. According to a study by the International Crisis Group, only 870,000 Haitians out of a potential 4 million have registered to vote. The election board has had trouble distributing voter ID cards, recruiting election workers, and preparing ballots. According to the news service OneWorld.net, supporters of the Lavalas Family Party of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide say their presidential candidate, Father Gerard Jean-Just, was excluded from the ballot. Father Juice was arrested in July on what Charles Arthur of the UK-based Haiti support group insists is a dubious charge of possessing illegal guns. Meanwhile, a team from the United Nations Human Rights Commission decried a catastrophic situation in Haiti, with acts of arbitrary arrest, torture, and summary executions by the Haitian National Police. The Village Voice reports a Marine Corps recruiter, Gunnery Sergeant Hubert Lucas, was convicted in a military court of providing false documents to undocumented immigrants so they could enlist in the military. Lucas was found guilty of fraudulent enlistment, conspiracy, dereliction of duty, and improper fraternization with an applicant before a military panel on Parris Island, South Carolina. At the trial, Lucas did not dispute the fact that enlistees had used counterfeit documents, but insisted that there was no evidence he had provided them. In August 2004, Lucas and three other recruiters became targets of a Navy criminal investigation for their work at the recruiting station in Perrine, Florida. The probe identified 23 recruits who used fraudulent documents like counterfeit green cards and Social Security numbers to enlist in the Marine Corps. During the time of the investigation, from 2002 to 2004, the Marine Corps exceeded its recruiting goals at the station, and Lucas received a productivity rating of above average. Two Indian tribes in Connecticut are considering their next move after a mid-October ruling by the Bureau of Indian Affairs reversed a decision granting them federal recognition. The BIA had granted federal recognition to the Eastern Pequots and to the Shattuck tribes in 2004. Shattuck Tribal Chairman Richard Velke says that the costs of pursuing federal recognition often force tribes to ally themselves with outside interests they might prefer not to deal with, and those are most often gambling interests. Velke says politicians need to separate the issue of federal recognition and gaming. The Interior Department ruled the tribes did not qualify for federal recognition because they could not prove they had existed as a tribe through the centuries, forming an intact cultural and social community. The tribes vehemently disagree, and the Shattuck say they will appeal the decision in federal court. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Melinda Tuhus. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
The October 15th referendum on Iraq's proposed constitution went forward with a lower level of violence than predicted. Despite a recent escalation of attacks by anti-occupation insurgents, there were relatively few strikes on military and civilian targets on the day of the Iraqi election. After hearing initial reports that voter participation may have been higher than last January's legislative election and opponents failed to defeat approval of the Constitution, President Bush praised the vote as a sign that Iraqis want to settle their disputes peacefully. But 2 days after counting ballots, the Independent Election Commission of Iraq said that they were investigating unusually high vote totals in 12 Shiite and Kurdish provinces, where in some cases, 99% of the votes were cast in favor of the draft constitution. Prominent leaders of Iraq's Sunni minority, who largely oppose the constitution, were quick to assert that the irregular vote tally may indicate fraud, calling into question the referendum's credibility. Despite last-minute negotiations to appease the Sunni voters by offering a chance to amend the constitution at a later date, early election results show most Sunnis opposed the charter. One of the most contentious provisions of the document on the minds of opponents was a fear that the sanction of autonomous zones in the oil-rich Kurdish north and a similar zone in the Shiite south would lead to a breakup of the nation. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hussein Ibish, executive director of the Hala Maqsood Foundation for Arab American Leadership. He discusses the results of Iraq's constitutional referendum and how it may affect the war and the timetable for a U.S. withdrawal.
There was really never any doubt that the constitution was going to survive. I mean, I think, in other words, the test that was built in, a two-thirds supermajority in three provinces, was never something that the organized Iraqi Sunni community, such as it is, and let's remember that unlike the Shiite fundamentalist groups and the Kurdish nationalist groups, who both have a very long-standing pre-existing political organizations that long predate the occupation and the new situation, you know, following the invasion, that the Iraqi Sunni community has no such thing, has no such organizations, that really they were never going to be able to do that, and particularly given the number of Shiites and Kurds who live in Baghdad province. So, you know, this really, I think, was always going to pass. Plus, it looks like there was additionally shenanigans. And then the thing is, this is Schubert's unfinished constitution. I mean, it's missing big sections that everyone agrees needed to be there. There were things they couldn't agree upon, so they just left them out. And, you know, even if they had addressed everything they set out to address, which they didn't, it still, you know, leaves 1,001 questions unanswered. It's a very rudimentary, very vague document that could be interpreted in a lot of different ways.
With preliminary vote results showing that many Sunnis voted against this constitution, does approval of this charter portend the eventual breakup of Iraq into three distinct autonomous zones, or maybe in the future separate states?
There are more elements that would tend, I think, ultimately to scenarios that are violent and possibly that sunder Iraq than that lead to reconciliation and democracy and compromise. There are basically four scenarios that can happen here. The first is, you know, what the president tells us is happening, that Iraqis will work out slowly their political system by compromise, by elections and plebiscites and writing constitutions and drafting and redrafting and, you know, the political system, and that the insurgency will sort of burn itself out. Sunnis will be brought slowly into the political process. They'll develop their political post-Ba'athist political parties, and over, you know, 5-6 years will be brought in, and then the Iraqis will come together and kick out the fringe foreign jihadists like led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and what have you, and those people will be gone, and Iraq will basically become a model pluralistic, you know, democracy in the Middle East. So that's scenario one, and I have to say there just isn't a lot of evidence for that. Scenario number two would be that for the next sort of, 5 to 10 years, Iraq basically hobbles along as it is. No major change. Scenario three would be, you know, a gradual reduction of the Western presence and a transition into a situation where one group or coalition of groups, probably a coalition of Shiite fundamentalist and Kurdish nationalist forces, the same groups that dominate the parliament, you know, would join together to violently, and I mean very violently, with extreme violence, impose their order, which is reflected in this constitution, where Kurds get their super autonomy in the north and Shiites get their quasi-theocracy in the rest of the country. The last scenario, scenario four, would be the same thing, an attempt to do that. The West getting out, you know, the U.S. basically getting out, making way for a wider conflict where a coalition of Shiites and Kurds confront the Sunnis and any secular Shiites. And rather than winning, as scenario three sort of posits, the whole thing descends into a giant chaos, and that it tends towards the breakup of the country and a descent into complete and total anarchy. Frankly, many of the signs lead in that kind of direction. I really, really wish that I could say otherwise, but I don't think I can.
The Bush administration says they're going to stay the course in Iraq. They're going to remain there with the U.S. troops until victory is won. At the same time, political realities are the Republicans are on the defensive. Right. Their poll numbers are horrendous, and they're going into a midterm election in November 2006. What prospect do you see that the U.S. is going to draw down the number of troops there by the November 2006 election?
I just don't think, as a political matter, it's plausible. Even if every Iraqi wanted us gone, and even if every American wanted to get out, I really don't think we can. I think it would be an incredible blow to the sense of power and prestige of the United States. I think, you know, we're stuck there. And I think it would sentence Iraq to an immediate and horrendous civil conflict that would be also unconscionable. We really have trapped ourselves into a situation where we just don't have any good options, and we don't have much control over the situation, and we don't know what we're doing.
That was Hussein Ibish, executive director of the Hala Maqsood Foundation for Arab American Leadership. Contact the group by visiting their website at www.halafoundation.org. The federal probe into who in the White House leaked the identity of a covert CIA agent to news reporters is drawing to a close. During his investigation, Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald questioned President Bush's senior advisor Karl Rove four times, confirming, despite early public denials, that he was at least one of those in the White House who revealed the identity of the CIA officer. Fitzgerald also succeeded in pressuring reluctant Time reporter Matt Cooper and the New York Times' Judith Miller to testify before the grand jury hearing the case. Although Miller initially refused to testify and was jailed on contempt charges for 85 days, she recently changed her mind and made a deal with Fitzgerald to be released after agreeing to speak before the grand jury. In Miller's own account of her testimony published in the Times, she confirms along with Cooper that Lewis Scooter Libby, a senior advisor to Vice President Cheney, was a source from whom she had received information about the identity of undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame. Plame is the wife of former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who had publicly debunked President Bush's pre-war declaration that Saddam Hussein was attempting to obtain uranium from the African nation of Niger for an Iraqi nuclear weapons program. As the nation awaits the conclusion of Fitzgerald's case, which could end in the indictment of Rove or Libby on charges of violating the Espionage Act or perjury, more important aspects of this affair are being overlooked by much of the corporate media. Central to the case is the Bush administration's use of dubious evidence to justify the Iraq War. The subsequent outing of CIA agent Plame appears to have been part of a larger White House effort to silence and punish the president's critics. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Boniface, constitutional attorney and co-founder of the group AfterDowningStreet.org, who explains why he believes this investigation must be broadened to include the false pretext under which the nation went to war with Iraq and the impeachable offenses that may have been committed by President Bush.
I do think that we need to get to the broader question of why this outing occurred, and the why gets us to the underlying lies and deception that the administration told the country and the Congress with respect to this war. Valerie Plame's husband, as we know, Ambassador Joe Wilson, came forward in July of 2003 with very clear evidence that the administration had hyped the case for war and had stated wrongly and untruthfully that Niger had tried to sell uranium to Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which was a major basis for the administration's case for taking the nation into war. Once Ambassador Wilson came forward with that evidence, the White House scrambled to do whatever it could to discredit him, went after his wife, and they did so because they saw their own cover-up of their lies and deception unraveling. And now we see, 2 years later, the results of that that kind of conduct. And in fact, it may result in indictments in federal court, and I think it may result in the further unraveling of this administration.
What are the connections that you see between the Valerie Plame disclosure case now being investigated and the revelations made in the infamous Downing Street memo for which your organization is named?
Well, they're directly linked because the Downing Street memo, the July 23rd, 2002 memo, which is really consists of minutes of an official meeting that occurred at 10 Downing Street in London, the Prime Minister's residence, where he heard a briefing from Sir Richard Dearlove, the senior British intelligence officer, that included the notation in the minutes that the President of the United States had decided already by that time, summer of 2002, to invade Iraq and to fix the intelligence around the policy. Now, if the intelligence was in fact being fixed, as these minutes revealed, then that would directly correspond with what Ambassador Wilson said on the op-ed pages of the New York Times in July of 2003 when he came forward with the evidence that he went to Niger, he investigated whether uranium had been sold to Iraq, and he found it all to be false. And yet the President himself and other members of the administration hyped the case for war based on that claim that uranium had been sold to Iraq. So it's directly linked with what we learned from the Downing Street minutes, and it really does raise the larger question of whether the President and top administration officials have engaged in a conspiracy to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people about the basis for going to war against Iraq. And if they did, I can think of no higher crime for a president to commit than to send this nation off into war based on potential lies. And that's why at AfterDowningStreet.org, we are continuing to press for an investigation into whether or not the president has committed impeachable offenses in connection with the Iraq war.
What is the likelihood, do you think, if there are indictments in the Valerie Plame case of Karl Rove or others in the White House, that those indictments may set off an environment in this country where an impeachment would be possible? Because right now, many political pragmatists look at that and think it's far-fetched.
Well, first, AfterDowningStreet.org just recently commissioned a poll from a reputable polling firm that demonstrated that 50% of Americans agree that the president should be impeached if it's shown that he lied to the nation, to the Congress, about the basis for taking this nation to war. Those numbers are far, far higher than any numbers that appeared at the height of the Clinton impeachment scandal, and they demonstrate that the public is far ahead of leaders in Washington on this question. I think what the indictments could very well do if they come forward is they could finally serve as the bridge between where the public is in demanding accountability and demanding answers and where Washington has failed to carry out its duty. And I think that if we in fact see Karl Rove or Scooter Libby or others in the White House administration indicted, we're going to see more courage and more leadership coming from Washington by those who are willing to stand up and demand accountability from this administration.
John Bonifaz, what is the most promising line of inquiry that you can point to that could reveal a smoking gun in terms of the Bush administration's collective knowledge about the false premise upon which the Iraq war was launched?
Well, of course, our position has been since May of this year that the Downing Street memo provided that smoking gun, and that Congress needed nothing more than that to launch a full investigation. However, I do think what could very well happen out of the Patrick Fitzgerald investigation with respect to Valerie Plame and the outing of her identity is we could see, if indictments go forward, a court process that further reveals the falsehoods that the Bush administration put forth to the nation, to Congress. And it could in fact become a broadened investigation to the other potential crimes the administration committed in connection with the outing of Valerie Plame. So I think that we don't know fully all of the potential documents that are out there, the whistleblowers that would be willing to come forward, the testimony that would happen under oath in those kinds of cases. We don't know fully, but we do have enough to go on with the Downing Street memo, with Ambassador Wilson's op-ed, and with what happened to Valerie Plame to know that this is a far, far deeper scandal than the public has even been able to fully become aware of. And time will only tell, you know, how this administration comes out of it. But I think that the fact is the writing's on the wall here. In essence, in history, it will be seen as the most reckless, or at least one of the most reckless administration in our nation's history.
That was John Boniface, constitutional attorney and co-founder of the group After DowningStreet.org, pressing to investigate the British Downing Street memos. Visit his group's website at www.afterdowningstreet.org. As New Orleans continues its slow recovery from the destruction of Hurricane Katrina, residents are dealing with hundreds of thousands of damaged buildings and mountains of trash. The mold growing everywhere poses a serious health problem, and the debris is smelly, unsightly, and in some cases, toxic. The first priority of many residents, city, state, and federal officials is to get rid of the trash, wipe the slate clean, and start over. But some people and organizations are proposing another route to cleanup, one that separates toxic trash from usable building materials, allowing for reuse of those materials to rebuild the damaged city. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alex Wilson, executive editor of Environmental Building News, based in Brattleboro, Vermont. In consultation with others in the green building movement, he published a 10-point plan for rebuilding New Orleans. The plan includes proposals for repairing the levees while restoring the floodplain, but focuses much attention on the buildings themselves and making New Orleans a model of 21st century construction. Wilson developed his plan based on the assumption that New Orleans will be rebuilt in its present site, despite the city's vulnerable location.
One of the recommendations to happen right away, should have happened already, would be to establish enterprise zone businesses in New Orleans to salvage and warehouse building materials that are going to be coming out of the homes that were destroyed through Hurricane Katrina. And we'd love to see those homes, at least many of those homes, deconstructed rather than simply torn down with bulldozers. Deconstructed in a way that the materials in those homes can be salvaged, warehoused, cleaned up, and used later in the reconstruction of homes in the city.
But so many of those buildings are so full of mold and other disgusting things that to clean it up would be such a Herculean task and maybe not even possible. Are you talking about other kinds of materials?
There's an entire range of materials and products, and indeed many of the homes and many of the wood-based materials are damaged beyond salvage, particularly from the mold that is now infused throughout the material. But there are other materials that can be salvaged. You know, it might be brick, it might be stone mantelpieces from older buildings. There's a whole range of materials that we felt could be salvaged and cleaned up. We felt that there was opportunity there to, you know, collect some of these resources, which are otherwise just going to fill up landfills and fill up a lot of landfills.
Doing that would also provide a lot more hours of work for people, right, than just bulldozing everything.
We looked at this as really a way to create local ownership of commerce. You know, create businesses that were locally owned, cooperatively owned, that hired local people, put them back to work in a productive way and got some money flowing into the economy again.
Another of your points is to mandate or incentivize green building, which is building that is environmentally friendly and energy efficient. There are hardly any green buildings in the entire country now, right?
That's correct. There are, you know, a few hundred that have gone through the LEED certification system. LEED is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, a program of the U.S. Green Building Council. The point is that a lot of taxpayer money is going into the rebuilding efforts, a huge amount of taxpayer money, and we should be looking at, you know, the big picture of the buildings that are going to be built through that investment of taxpayer support. And we should be creating buildings that are going to be healthy for the environment, healthy for people to live in, and durable, so that we're not coming back in 10 years and rebuilding them because of mold problems or moisture management problems. And one of the best ways to ensure that is to insist that buildings go through some sort of certification program. And for public buildings, we've recommended that these buildings go through the LEED certification system.
Have you done any outreach to people working at the grassroots level in New Orleans to see what they think of these ideas? I've spoken to the environmental justice organizer for the Sierra Club in New Orleans and also to a representative of ACORN, which works with low-income people on issues mostly of jobs and affordable housing. And some of the things they said overlapped with your proposals.
We haven't done as much of that as we would like to. Our company is also hosting a listserv about rebuilding after Katrina that's been organized by the Department of Energy and several other sustainability proponents. And through that listserv, which has significant participation from the New Orleans area, you know, we do know that these ideas are getting into the discussions of some of the groups that are focused on the rebuilding effort in that region.
That was Alex Wilson, executive editor of Environmental Building News. For more information, call Building Green at area code 802-257-7300. Or visit their website at www.buildinggreen.com, where the entire 10-point reconstruction plan is posted. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is hoping for your membership and your participation. Go to wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote, as reported in the New York Times, of Gulf War veteran and Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. He said, "I understand what they felt in Oklahoma City. I have no sympathy for them." He felt the people he killed were collateral damage.